Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Greg Largent, producer with Wolf Dog Radio. Just have a short little piece I'm going to read before we start tonight's show. Good evening. Thank you for listening to this edition of Wolf Dog Radio. The staff at Wolf Dog Radio would like to extend their condolences and prayers to all that suffered the loss of a family member or friend, or had a family member or friend injured in the insanity that took place in Las Vegas last week. A moment of silence for those that are suffering through this horror, and I hope that something is done to alleviate the pain and suffering for such items.
The opinions expressed on Wolf Dog Radio by our guests and participants of the audience are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the production team of the hosts of Wolf Dog Radio. We are open to your ideas for future radio programs. Please feel free to email us with questions or comments at questions@wolfdogradio.com.
Good evening. I'm Rachel Tilseth, and welcome to Wolf Dog Radio. Once a year, Wisconsin has a special week for celebrating wolves called Wolf Awareness Week. Wolves of Douglas County, Wisconsin hosts a special premiere screening of a film about wolves during Wolf Week in Madison at the Barrymore Theater. And this year, we are privileged to screen Gray Area Wolves of the Southwest, produced by Alan Lacey, and it takes place October 18th at 7 p.m. In the closing of tonight's show, I'll provide more details of this screening. In tonight's show, I'll be talking with Alan Lacey, the producer of the award-winning documentary film, The Gray Area, Wolves of the Southwest. In the Southwest, a unique species of wolf unlike any other is making a comeback. Considered extinct nearly 40 years ago, the little-known Mexican gray wolf has slowly pulled back from the very brink against all odds. After these messages, we will return with Alan Lacey.
From the moment a puppy comes into the world, the soul of a wolf is also born. And even as adults, they continue to share an evolutionary connection, one that's best reflected in their love for meat. That's why there's Blue Wilderness. It's made with more of the meat your dog desires. Blue Wilderness, because inside your dog lives the soul of a wolf.
This is Paula Ficarra.
And Steve Westell.
Founders of Apex Protection Project.
And you're listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Hello, Alan. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Good.
Thanks for taking the time to help me with the film and some of the things I've been doing the last couple of years, and have the opportunity to talk to you or share it with everybody.
Can you give us a rundown on who appears in the film and anything else pertinent to making of the film?
Certainly. So the film itself is called Gray Area, Wolves of the Southwest, and it's a 15-minute documentary film with a group of gray wolf that lives in the American Southwest. And it's been a passion project over the last 5 or so years, and I've been able to gain access to film with some of the organizations such as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Arizona Game and Fish Department. And through that, I've been able to connect with some of the biologists that work on the program. And it was really cool to be able to have that experience to work with them and learn more about the recovery of the Mexican wolf itself. Some of the people that are in the film are people like Dave Parsons, who was the recovery program coordinator at the very beginning of the entire process of restoring the Mexican wolf back to the wild. He was part of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And another person is Sherry Barrett, who also is the current recovery program coordinator for the program. And then we also, in the film, explore some of the different sides of the issue of wolf recovery. So we've got people that are on both sides, and that would be people such as Gene and Peter Osorio. They are highly engaged activists that travel throughout the region in the Southwest advocating for the recovery of the wolf. Really, really awesome people. And people like Craig Miller from Defenders of Wildlife.
Yeah, when I was viewing the film, I thought they were remarkable, the couple that you're talking about. They were...
Yes, they are really cool. And it's a cool, interesting fact that we don't really elaborate on the film, but Jean and her husband, Peter, they camp out in the wolf recovery area pretty extensively throughout the year. And I think since the wolves have been released into the wild in 1998, collectively, they have, well, Jean herself has spent over a year camping in the wild, over 365 nights in wolf recovery area. And it's pretty cool, phenomenal fact that she's seen the most wolves in the wild of anyone, non-biologist, of course. Really awesome people. We also talk with Craig Miller from Defenders of Wildlife, and he gives us some insights into how Defenders is working to help mitigate some of the issues between livestock producers and the wolves. And he works closely with the Fish and Wildlife and works with them on a lot of different various mitigation techniques. We also interview a few ranchers that have been affected by the wolves there. And one of the ranchers we spent several days with, amazing person, who's really quite an interesting character, which you'll see in the film. Interesting little thing is he feels like he could be a grandpa. And something about the film that I really wanted to show was both sides, so that hopefully we can come to a common ground to be able to bring a discussion to the table, so to speak. And, you know, people are people on both sides, and that's something I really wanted to show is how to work with people on both sides so that we can hopefully create that discussion. And then we travel to some other locations like St. Louis, to the Endangered Wolf Center, talk about the Species Survival Plan, which we can get into a little bit later. And, yeah, that's pretty much the gist of the film in terms of who we've worked with on it.
Yeah, you know, I was very impressed with your film upon viewing it. And, you know, if this is your first time producing a film, please keep making more. You're a natural at the talent.
So, thanks.
Yeah, it was really good. I was very impressed with your producing. You know, you did an excellent job. So can you tell our listeners what led you to make this film in the first place?
Well, thank you for giving such kind words there. I know this is my first production that I've worked on, and it's been quite a learning experience. You know, my background is in aviation. It's something completely and totally new to me. What started off as mainly just an interest in wildlife, and I've always had that since a child. I volunteered at a rehabilitation center for wildlife in Scottsdale, Arizona, and they had 18 Mexican gray wolves that were residing at the facility at the time, and I was instantly enthralled by them because they were a critically endangered species. Roughly 42 of them were in the wild at that time, and this was back in like 2005 or 6 or 7, one of those years. I think it was 2007. And it just kind of blew my mind in terms of the fact that there was just so few in the wild, and here I was at this facility, and there were 18 of them, and it represented quite a substantial percentage of the entire population of Mexican wolves that were on Earth, and it was quite humbling to be in that area of the world and just think this is insane. And so I just, my heart just kind of, I could feel the need to do something, and it just sort of stayed at bay for quite a few years until I got married and was working in the aviation industry, like I said, and decided, you know, I need to do something. So I reached out to several people, and one of the folks that responded was a PBS host and narrator. He's the one who actually narrates our film. And he said, If only he could say, you know, have you ever thought about doing this? You know, you don't have to be an expert in wolves or in anything. You can just go out and get people and put the professionals behind the camera and the professionals in front of the camera and just need to coordinate that. And that started the film. And what started out as a five-minute film project turned into a 30-minute film project, and that turned into a full-length hour slot for hopefully maybe someday a television broadcast slot. Pretty much how I kind of got launched into it, and a lot of trial and error, and I got connected with a lot of high-end professional cameramen. One of them, my director, Jim Cannon, a lifesaver and a lifeline to make sure that the production went as smoothly as it did. And hats off to him for making the film stand out like it does with the beautiful shots he was able to capture and for the direction he provided over the course of the production itself. Been quite a lot of learning experience with. I thoroughly enjoyed, and yes, I plan on making others.
I hope so. That kind of brings us into The Mexican Gray Wolf. That was your inspiration. And so Can you tell us a little bit about what makes the Mexican Gray Wolf unique and that makes this film unique?
Certainly. Everybody has seen and heard of wolves, of course. And here in North America, we have the gray wolf, and they are one of the most widely dispersed wolves and canids on the planet. The Mexican gray wolf is a genetically distinct subspecies of the northern gray wolf. So you have like Canis lupus, which is the gray wolf. Mexican wolf is Canis lupus baleyi. And they are basically intrinsic to the landscape of Mexico and in the southwestern United States. They are smaller than northern gray wolves. They can be about 25% smaller. And they have very distinct genetic markers that distinguish them as a separate subspecies, much in the way that you might see like brown bears, which is Ursus arctos. You have the grizzly, which is Ursus arctos horribilis, and the Kodiak brown bear, which is Ursus arctos mittendorfi, which those kind of differences is kind of how you would relate the gray wolf to the Mexican gray wolf. They both exhibit distinct differences, etc. So the Mexican gray wolf also has some pretty distinct color markings that are different than northern gray wolves, where you have different phases of wolves and the regular gray wolf population. You can have white, you can have black, you can have brown and gray mixes, whereas the Mexican gray wolf is pretty much all the same exact color marking. You have some variation in terms of how much reds and copper tones they have in it, but for the most part, they all look pretty much the same. They're, in my opinion, some of the most unique and beautiful colors of wolves that you'll see out there. You see them, and they just sort of like, for me, they just really leave a distinct mark in your mind about seeing them. Very, very striking. They have, I guess you could say, a reddish tint with their gray and black and brown. I don't know, you got to look at the differences between them, and you'll see, and it's really, they're awesome. They definitely have a soft spot in my heart now for this project.
Well, I think they're beautiful, too. I agree with you. I think they definitely are unique. So can you tell us about the plight of the Mexican gray wolf? What happened and what led to their extinction in the wild?
Well, as anyone has followed wolf recovery or wolves in general over the years, there was a tremendous campaign to exterminate what was considered vermin and nuisance wildlife in the late 1800s, moving into the early 1900s, especially as settlers moved across the landscape as we moved into the United States here. There was a huge business to exterminate these creatures, and Mexican wolves obviously fell under that same treatment. So as wolves were being exterminated across the United States, they were being exterminated in the Southwest as well. And that led to kind of a bottleneck of wolves getting shot and killed to the point where there was really only just a few handfuls of wolves left in Mexico. And in the 1923, when the Endangered Species Act was enacted by Congress, it designated the Mexican wolf and gray wolves as an endangered species here in the United States. And they sent a trapper down into Mexico between 1977 and 1980 to capture any of the wolves he could find. And he found five wolves in three different locations.
and only one of them was actually a female, which is pretty remarkable considering that the species came with one female going extinct, which is pretty crazy. How do you recover species from that? It's pretty amazing how well the species survival plan, which was implemented to bring the wolf back from that very brink, and how they went about doing so. So they basically brought these five wolves into captive facilities, and they worked really, really hard on breeding this one female. And the way you save the genetics is you breed as quickly as possible and produce as many puppies as possible to express the entire genetic makeup that that wolf can provide, the whole genome there. And they were able to save over half of the genetic material of the Mexican wolf, which is, again, pretty remarkable. A little bit later, they found a few extra wolves, four other wolves in two other facilities that they determined were purebred, but they kept them separate until the 90s when they decided to merge the two lineages or three lineages together, which is where the Mexican wolves can all trace their history to. So it's pretty amazing. So there are seven founding animals, and that's how the whole Mexican wolf population today can trace its roots back to. It's pretty remarkable. Oh, and also 1998, when they finally got to the point where they could release wolves from back into the wild, they released 11 of them. And since 1998, they've been slowly increasing. Today there are, as of the last population count, 113 in the wild. So it's interesting to see how this year turns out.
That's pretty amazing. They went from seven founding animals to that.
And something, too, to add to it is that if you were to look at it, is they're all related, essentially. And canids have a very unique way of doing that. They have they're one of the only species out there that can really breed as closely related as they can be that way and still be able to express healthy and proper genetics.
Right. So that goes into kind of my next question. Yeah, Alan, can you explain about the threat from within now, within their own genetics?
Certainly. They the Mexican wolf, because it went down to basically those seven animals, and they've worked so hard to create as much genetic expression as they can within the population. They have done, like I said, a remarkable job of doing so. And over the years, the wolf numbers kept increasing as the population grew. And now there's more and more packs that are navigating across the landscape. And for a period of time, things were working really well. Eventually, there became some nuisance and problem wolves, and they had to do some management procedures to remove some of these wolves from the wild that were being problematic. There's been some controversy that has surrounded some of that, which basically resulted in quite a few wolves being removed from the population, whether lethally or being live trapped and removed, and quite a substantial number to the point where they were not essentially growing in areas of the recovery zone in Arizona. And one particular pack in Arizona was a very prolific breeding pack, and they produced litter after litter and high quantities of puppies in every litter, and it just became like this breeding factory for wolves. And so this one pack has now pretty much infiltrated the whole entire population in the Southwest. So almost every wolf in the population currently in the wild is kind of related to this one pack, the blue stem pack. In our film, we actually filmed some of the small little pups there from the blue stem pack, cutest little things. But what this means is that they're all pretty much related genetically, as almost on the order of how brothers are related to sisters, and that can create a lot of genetic issues when some scientists are fearing that a potential genetic extinction, because they're all so closely related, we're having a genetic bottleneck, which litter sizes to be smaller. And then there's also other issues with male infertility. And so there's a bunch of various problems that can come from this, as well as managers are working really hard to try to get the ship back on the right track to hopefully increase new genetics into the population to help fix this issue, because otherwise, like I said, they fear that we could have another
a genetic extinction rather than an actual physical extinction.
Alan, can you tell us a little bit about the one wolf that has helped the survival of the species? Can you go into, I believe you, her name is Ernesto? Ernesta, is that right?
That is correct. Ernesta is her name. She is kind of our central character in the film. She represents an overarching element, which is the genetics themselves, which kind of really is our champion in the film. And it was a captive reared wolf, and she has really, really valuable genetics, genetics that are underrepresented in the wild population. So back in 2012, she was selected by the Mexican Wolf Species Survival Plan folks in their yearly meetings that they do to be released into the wild to help boost the population's genetics. So we flew to the Endangered Wolf Center. I got a camera, not Dean McCammon, but I believe we hired somebody else, and we went to St. Louis to the Ninja Wolf Center, and we filmed a couple other wolves being prepared for the trip to New Mexico along with Ernesta, who came from the Brookfield Zoo. She happened to be born at the Endangered Wolf Center as well. Kind of interesting how they're all connected. And she was paired with a mate. Soon she got pregnant and was ready for a litter of pups, and so they got her transferred into a holding pen in the wild with her mates. And unfortunately, her pups didn't make it the first time around, and another wild pack happened to move in the area. So they had to remove her from the wild. Next year they tried again. This time, instead of putting her in a holding pen, they released her heart into the wild, and her wild-born mate at that time abandoned her, but yet she still managed to whelp her pups. And because her mate abandoned her, they decided the best action was to pull her back into captivity to give her the best chances of survival because of her genetics being so valuable. But what was really interesting is they took a couple of her pups, two of them out of her litter of six, and they placed those two pups from her into a wild pack, and an operation that is known as cross-fostering. And the technique they've done in the Red Wolf program for quite a long time, and they kind of pioneered it there, and it worked really well. And so the Mexican Wolf field team decided to try that, and it worked as well here. And it's interesting that the wild-born wolves or pack actually raised these captive-born wolves, I guess you could say, as their own. Pretty remarkable. Eventually, Ernesta was released again later into the wild, and with her pups and her a new mate. You have to watch the film to kind of see how things go towards the end, how that all plays out. But it kind of really encapsulates some of the challenges of the entire Mexican Wolf program, but she really was a beacon of hope for her entire species, and paving the way forward for some of the new techniques they're doing today, which is really exciting.
Well, that you kind of answered my next question then, about the cross-fostering and how that works.
Yeah, I guess I could elaborate a little bit more about cross-fostering too. It's a pretty interesting technique. What they do is essentially they take pups that are from the pack that they're, like, say, from for Ernesta's pups, for example, and they take those two pups and they place them into that wild den, and they mix urine and the feces and pup smell, dirt, whatever they can get in there that smells like the wild-born pack, and they just mix all the puppies together so that they all smell the same, so that when the wild mother comes in, she can accept them all. They all smell the same. There's no foreign scent, and it's working really well. In fact, they've last couple of years since then, for example, this year, they actually did several operations where they were flying pups that were born in captivity in centers like the Brookfield Zoo or the Endangered Wolf Center, several other locations at facilities across the United States. And you have to be able to pair these young pups with wolves in the wild, and they have to be born almost within a 1 or 2 day window. It has to be very, very close to each other. So if you know when the pups are whelped in the wild, and you can tell that by the localizing of the female when she goes into her den, you can get a pretty close to accurate estimation on when those pups are whelped. And then you know for a fact when the pups are whelped in captivity, because they do a very good job of moving from that. You have to be able to get them there very, very soon. And so it's pretty remarkable. All these things have to align perfectly. You have to have a female wolf in the wild and a female in captivity, basically whelp pups at the same time in order to make it successful. So far, they've done it
six wolves have been done, have been cross fostered since then, and I know as of a few months ago, they had three of them are, they've been able to determine are still around in the wild right now, from this year's current cross fostering that they've been able to document. And there's the other three they haven't been able to document yet, but it doesn't mean that they're not still out there. They could well be out and about. So it's been very successful.
It sounds like it. So I'm really happy that they're doing that. I've been watching the progress of these captive animals and the breeding programs for a number of years, and it seems like it's really working well. So, Alan, why don't you go into know some of the things that cause the conflicts within this whole program? Like, can you expand on how the film presents the locals, the ranchers, and the conservationists, and the biologists, and how they're all able to coexist with the Mexican gray wolf? If you could expand on that.
Yeah, so one of the big things that it surrounds wolves is always the way and how you manage them, and then how you live with them, and people that want to ensure they remain on the landscape. And it's a very interesting dynamic between all these different parties. You have people that want them there, you have people that don't want them there, and you have folks that are working hard to ensure they stay there, and are managing them from a wildlife management perspective. And so in one sense, you can say they all kind of coexist with each other, even though in coexistence, I'm not sure if I want to use that, because some, it's at the point where a lot of the ranchers are accepting now the fact that wolves are here to stay, so they are learning how to work with different programs like range riding programs or different mitigation techniques to help reduce the conflict between wolves and livestock. And they understand that there are people like who really want to see wolves propagate around the landscape. And so, you know, I think all the parties understand the issues pretty well, but I would imagine after talking with some of the locals that it's more of an identity-based issue with the wolf. The wolf kind of challenges the ideals of the rancher, and the same thing for the conservation side of things. It's kind of become, the wolf has become more of the kind of, I don't know how to describe the best way, but the wolf is, it's really not the issue about the wolf so much as it is about the identity of these different cultures of folks. So you have wildlife managers who are working to try to alleviate these concerns on both sides. So the Mexican wolf kind of gets trapped in the middle between this issue. And part of the purpose of my film, like I was mentioning earlier, is to try to bring that discussion, to get people on both sides talking about it, to really understand that the wolf is just a wolf and is only going to do what a wolf is going to do. And they aren't out there ravaging and killing hundreds and hundreds of cattle every year, at least the Mexican wolf population. And, you know, wolves in general, just that's not their MO. I mean, they're out there to hunt and kill elk and deer. Of course, they do kill cattle occasionally, but that's not their staple in their diet, of course. Whereas some people might believe that, the science and the facts really don't back that up. So it's about properly educating and bringing that discussion, and that's what I'm hoping my film will do. And so on the conservation side of things, we also got to understand that wolves are not a fluffy, stuffed toy animal either. I mean, they are a wolf. They can be dangerous. They generally shy away from people. They don't really engage with us. The times that we were in the wild, I was never concerned about my safety. So there's that aspect of it, too, that, you know, we just need to figure out what the real wolf is and bring a discussion back to what is the real wolf. And hopefully that can bring that discussion to a point where we can create progress moving into the future. And so it's something that I really hope the film conveys well. I mean, I present both sides as fair and balanced as possible. So.
I think it does, that your film presents all of those sides. And I like what you say. It's very true. Presenting the problems in saving the wild wolf, and it's also having us look at these magnificent animals. So I think your film shows that. you know, there's a lot there that they have to go through to survive, and we need to help them. And they are wild, and we have to remember that these are wild animals. They have that right. So I agree with you. So now I understand that your film is screening at several film festivals around the country, and it's been doing very well from what I've been reading. So can you tell our listeners where and when the screening will occur in...
Yeah, so...
You know, just the next couple ones beside the Madison one?
Yeah, well, I'm really excited about that. It's going to be awesome. It's, you know, obviously we want to get as many people are interested in learning more about the Mexican gray wolf to be sure to come out to Madison and be able to watch the film there at the Barrymore Theater. I'm sure there'll be some details attached to this radio interview as well, so be sure to come out to that. And that is on the 18th of this month, October. Then I'm actually going to, the film will be going to the G2 Green Earth Film Festival in L.A., and that's going to be showing on the 20th in L.A. there. So for folks, you can go to our website for the film, which is grayareathefilm.com, and that's G-R-A-Y, gray, not G-R-E, so it's G-R-A-Y, areathefilm.com. Go to our screenings page, and we have it all current listed there. The 20th, the G2 Green Earth Film Festival, we were one of 18 films selected for this festival out of, I think, 1,400 films that were submitted, which is pretty awesome. I'm pretty excited about that. Unfortunately, I won't be able to make that one, but I will be actually traveling to New York after the screening in Madison to the Wildlife Conservation Film Festival, where it's showing on the 22nd at the 8 p.m. slot. Series 12 there in Manhattan proper. So it's going to be exciting. First time in New York, it's going to be amazing. A lot of awesome films there at this festival. And then I'll be traveling actually to Rotterdam, Netherlands shortly after that, at the end of the month, to show the film at two screenings there in Rotterdam, which is pretty exciting, at the Wildlife Film Festival Rotterdam. So it'll be amazing to see the film actually go international there and premiere internationally. And then shortly after that, we're in St. Louis, the film at the St. Louis International Film Festival. That will be screened at 6 p.m. on the 9th there in St. Louis. So, yeah, make sure you check it out, our current screenings. I would hope to see people that can make it out. It would be amazing to meet you guys. Of course, be able to watch the film, too, which is I believe it's an important film to really bring these issues and discuss them and hopefully bring more awareness to the Mexican wolf in the Southwest, as not many people are familiar that there are actually wolves down there.
And you had told me one time there was, at one of these festivals, there was an actor there. Who was that?
Oh, yeah. We went to the Albuquerque Film and Music Experience earlier this year in June. And for those of you who keep up with actors in Hollywood films, Jeff Bridges was there. He was the Highlander guy. And one of his good friends, T-Bone Burnett, which is a music producer who's produced many bands and acts throughout the years. You know, he's well known in the industry, and you just look him up and you see all the amazing bands and stuff he's worked with, musicians. So it was a really cool experience, and Jeff is an awesome guy. He's actually a pretty good musician too.
Yes, I've kind of heard that. Well, say now, can you tell us some of the awards that the Gray Area has won? Gray Area has won.
Sure, yeah, no problem. I didn't expect to even get my film into festivals, so this has been quite an experience over the last several months. But, the film's done very well, and it's been received well. Just like, for example, the first film festival I got in, which I was pretty excited about, was the International Wildlife Film Festival, and we actually pretty much sold out both screenings there, which is pretty cool. But, anyways, moving to the Albuquerque Film Music Fest, we won Best Documentary Short there, which was quite shocking. I did not expect that. But, again, it's really awesome to see the story of the wolf, the Mexican wolf, really shine and take the spotlight there. And people, it really resonated with the folks there in New Mexico, and that's exactly what it was intended to do. And it was really awesome, very humbling, and one of the most amazing experiences. And if anyone gets a chance to go to that film festival, I highly recommend it in the future. Great place, great times. And then we just recently won best documentary feature at the Jerome Indie Film Fest in Arizona, one of the top 25 coolest film festivals in the world. So that was pretty cool.
I've been watching online to see what the film is winning, and it's adding up. You're not going to have much room on your picture anymore. So many you're adding up.
Yeah, we've gotten 7 selections now at the festival, which is pretty cool.
That is pretty good. Your film hasn't been released yet, and so it's not available. They can't go out and purchase it online or DVD. But can you tell the listeners how they can help you get it released? We want to get that in there.
Definitely, and that would be a huge help. So if any of you are interested in helping support getting this film out to the world as quick as possible, please go to my website, which is grayareathefilm.com, and just look for any of those donate buttons. Click on that and feel free to give whatever you are interested in doing. I will say, if you can put on there for at least 20 minutes, ensure that your name and email and address is included. I will make sure that I list you at the appropriate level to receive there's a lot of cost that involves into producing DVDs, legal costs, contracts for the various things here and there with festivals, et cetera. So as much as we can get the help on that, the sooner we can get this film out to the world.
Is there anything else you want to add, Alan, in here, on anything else you want to add on making a film or?
Well, I would say probably, for anyone who's interested in learning more about the Mexican Grey Wolf, feel free to hop onto our website, like I've mentioned, grayareathefilm.com. There's a lot of those resources out there, but for anyone looking at making a film, my advice would be just to get out and do it. It's something, like I said, that I had no experience in before, and just have this passion to make something happen. And just, don't be afraid to ask questions. Just get out there and do. My dad always had this thing, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, so you don't want to be a nuisance by any means, but you definitely, if you have something and you're really passionate about, get out there and do it and achieve your goals and make it happen. There are two types of people in this world, the people that do and the people that do not. So I decided I wanted to be a person that does, and so that's how I managed to make this happen. A lot of energy, a little learning, and anybody can do it. I'm just a guy with a business career who's a lot of times and has a lot of life, and just go out and make it happen.
And I'm glad you did, and I think you're a very passionate filmmaker, and I want to see some more films from Alan Lacy in the future.
I've got a few in the works. We'll see what happens.
Yes. So I want to thank you for letting me interview you on Wolf Dog Radio, and we're going to end it here and say good night. So thank you, Alan.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the time, and we're looking forward to being out there in Madison.
Yes, I look forward to meeting you in Madison. So you have a good rest of your evening, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you, Alan. Please join us in listening to the audio from the trailer for Gray Area Wolves of the Southwest.
There are competing visions for the future of the West. And what traditional ranchers see as the future is very different than what conservationists see for the future. Mexican wolves are kind of trapped between those competing visions.
In the American Southwest, the Mexican gray wolf is considered one of the most endangered land mammals in the world. It is in this wild and rugged place where the Mexican wolf is making its return to the wild. And starting over from only 7 founding animals means the genetic health of the population is still a fragile and challenging one.
The Mexican gray wolves in the wild are highly inbred. We're at a very critical point. Every genetically valuable wolf is very important to the population.
But their return is highly controversial.
How far do we have to expand the territory on the concept of preserving these species? How far does it have to go?
Can Mexican wolves live alongside us? Or will history repeat itself once again?
I think that would be a tragedy if we let this species go when we had the opportunity to do something about it.
Rewilding is the idea of putting wildness back in nature. We've come a long way in unwilding nature, you might say, by taking the wildest creatures out of it, particularly the large predators. We know that that's had a significant effect on how nature works, and we lose species, things go out of whack, and it's because the large predators aren't in nature who have their controlling effect and keep everything in balance. It's kind of an overused term, but I think it makes a lot of sense in terms of thinking about the role of predators. The idea, what the opposite of rewilding has made nature extremely simple. It has taken animals out. It has eliminated various interactions between animals that we don't even have a clue how important those are. But we know that if we can put nature back together by putting the wild pieces, all the wild pieces back in, we know that nature responds, and that it becomes healthier, that ecosystems become healthier, that more species have places to live. And we're sitting in a perfect spot to be talking about that, because we're sitting in Yellowstone National Park. And Yellowstone National Park is the one place in the country where nature has been put back together like it was 200 years ago and even longer. And we're seeing a flourishing of nature in response to particularly putting the wolves back in.
This is Ian Dunbar, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Welcome, Krista Ward, and the Vet Tech is in.
The Vet Tech is in.
Thank you for listening to Wolf Dog Radio, and this is The Vet Tech is in. My name is Krista Ward, and tonight I wanted to discuss parvovirus in canines. Canine parvovirus infection in dogs is a highly contagious viral illness that affects dogs only. The virus manifests itself in two different forms. The more common form is the intestinal form, which is characterized by vomiting, diarrhea, weight loss, and lack of appetite. The less common form is the cardiac form, which attacks the heart muscles of very young puppies, often leading to death. The majority of cases are seen in puppies that are between 6 weeks and 6 months old. The incidence of canine parvovirus infections have been reduced radically by early vaccination in young puppies. The major symptoms associated with the intestinal form of canine parvovirus infection include severe bloody diarrhea, lethargy, anorexia, fever, vomiting, and severe weight loss. The intestinal form of canine parvovirus affects the body's ability to absorb nutrients, and an affected animal will quickly become dehydrated and weak from lack of protein and fluid absorption. The wet tissue of the mouth and the eyes may become noticeably red, and the heart may beat too rapidly. When your veterinarian palpates your dog's abdominal area, your dog may respond with pain or discomfort. Dogs that have contracted canine parvovirus may also have a low body temperature rather than a fever. How is parvovirus spread? Most cases of canine parvovirus infections are caused by a genetic alteration of the original canine parvovirus, the parvovirus type 2B. There are a variety of risk factors that can increase a dog's susceptibility to the disease, but mainly parvovirus is spread either by direct contact with an infected dog or indirectly by fecal-oral route. Heavy concentrations of the virus are found in an infected dog's stool. So when a healthy dog sniffs an infected dog's stool, it will contract the disease. The virus can also be brought into a dog's environment by way of shoes that have come into contact with infected feces. There is evidence that the virus can live in the ground or soil for up to or over a year. It is resistant to most cleaning products or even to weather changes. If you need to clean up a parvovirus contaminated area, first pick up and safely dispose of all organic material, vomit, feces, etc., and then thoroughly wash the area with a household bleach solution, one of the few disinfectants known to kill the virus. Improper vaccination protocol and vaccination failure can also lead to canine parvovirus infection. Breeding kennels and dog shelters that hold a large number of inadequately vaccinated puppies are particularly hazardous places. For unknown reasons, certain dog breeds such as Rottweilers, Doberman Pinschers, Pit Bulls, Labrador Retrievers, German Shepherds, English Springer Spaniels, and Alaskan Sled Dogs are particularly vulnerable to the disease. Diseases or drug therapies that suppress the normal response of the immune system may also increase the likelihood of infection. Canine parvovirus is similar to the long-known feline panleukopenia virus. Soon after its appearance, parvo was classified as a mutation of panleukopenia. In fact, the first vaccines used against parvo were HPV vaccines. Prior to the parvovirus outbreak, the only widely used vaccine for dogs was distemper. At some point, cat kidneys were used to develop the distemper vaccine, and this was shipped around the whole world and injected into dogs. Another possibility is that cats that were vaccinated for HPV shed that vaccine through their feces, a very real risk with modified live vaccines. The feline parvovirus could have easily mutated into canine parvovirus. In vaccines for biodefense in emerging and neglected diseases, the authors state that the trouble with the modified live vaccine is, end quote, there is a high probability of back mutation and reversion to virulence once introduced to the animals, unquote. Regardless of how canine parvovirus originated, it is well accepted that it is a man-made disease and it is the result of vaccination, either for canine distemper or HPV. This much is obvious because the outbreaks were sudden and massive, and they first surfaced in countries that regularly vaccinated dogs and cats. As with all new viruses, parvo is constantly evolving and mutating, but it has a faster mutation rate than most other viruses. Today, nearly 35 years later, parvo remains the most common viral disease in dogs. Diagnosis of parvo is easily completed by your veterinarian. There are parvo tests available that take 10 minutes. All that they need is a stool sample from the possibly infected patient to be able to distinguish whether it's parvovirus or not. Another form of diagnosing a patient would be to collect a blood sample, also known as a CBC, to check and see where the white blood cell count is. If the white blood cell count is low, then it is a possibility that they have contracted parvovirus. Treatment for parvovirus is not limited to hospitalization, but it is recommended. IV fluids are key. Veterinarians also may use multiple forms of GI tract medication, such as metronidazole, also known as Flagyl, and they may put your pet on a prescription diet when they go home. Parvovirus is very, very serious, and many pets don't make the transition into being fully healthy once they've contracted the virus. Their immune system is always compromised afterwards. Prevention of parvovirus is given with vaccination. Vaccination should be on a schedule of 6 weeks, 9 weeks, 12 weeks, and 16 weeks of age. Puppies should receive a set of 4 vaccinations to be fully protected. Owners of puppies should not take their new pets into heavily populated areas where other pets have been or other people, such as pet stores or Lowe's or Home Depot, or that kind of thing until they're fully vaccinated. Vaccination is the key to keeping your pet as healthy as possible, although they are not 100% effective. If you suspect that your pet has contracted parvovirus, take them to the vet immediately. The faster that you get your pet treated, the better chance that they have of recovering. Thank you for listening to The Vet Tech Is In. This is Krista Ward, and have a great night.
time for everyone's favorite, Ragin' Cajun Jerry Mills.
This is Jerry Mills, and this is the Wolf Tejas Den. Well, the month of September has came and went in a complete blur for me. All this recovery effort and getting us a home to live in, which has taken shape in the form of a gently used 40-foot camper with four big slide-outs. The donkeys were the first ones to get to come home, as they didn't need no supervision and were here all alone. The camper came next, and it was a two-day ordeal just to get it down to Texas, which is where we found a deal. Well, then, of course, the rock base was poured out and leveled, and the house pulled up on it, and it got all blocked and leveled with water, electricity, and the sewer all ran. The old house had to have all the water-soaked, nasty, moldy crap took out of it and hauled off, and including flooring and sheetrock. A few things salvageable had to be separated. The enclosures had to be cleared of debris and the houses all put back up. The fences repaired, gates reinstalled, ground wire replaced in some of the pens. The other dogs were brought back a few at a time till they were all back home now. In the midst of all this, my dear friend, Donald Lewis, took a turn for the worse and fell victim to cancer. Don requested me to take his beloved pets and see that they were cared for and allowed to carry on their bloodlines. We call them the Dream Team. That would be Shaman and Shade. I made a 2,011-mile round trip in 3 days to go get Shaman and Shade. Shade was born here from Ruckus and Josie, and Shaman is from John Basil. All this would not have been possible without the help from my Wolf Dog Radio family, as well as many folks from the Wolf Dog community that so generously gave and came to our aid. Y'all know who you are. And a special thanks goes to Deanna and Greg, as well as Kim and NLA. A big shout out to Sue at Tigers for Tomorrow for her huge generosity. Another huge shout out goes to Bob Trackman, and another to Nancy Brown. A very special thanks to Heather Green for coming and helping me work in the heat and skeeters for a week. There's too many to list, and everyone's so appreciated, one and all. Y'all hold a special place in our hearts for your kindness and generosity in making a horrible situation much more bearable. I'll never forget it. You know, it's times like these that big lessons are learned. Lessons on how to improve your evacuation and lessons on how to best deal with animals' needs and containment while they're away from home. You never know how long you might have to be gone. There's no time to screw around and try to figure out what one needs to do. There's barely time to do what needs to be done. It's literally a do-or-die effort. Things will never be the same here. It really sucks, as we were very happy with our home and our routine. We rebuilt after Hurricane Ike and made some nice improvements. Well, this time is different. But I'm sure in time it will become a much better situation. Well, fall is approaching, and the hormones are starting to change with our animals. Everyone needs to be aware of the subtleties and changes that are taking place. Just a little slight testing will start. Animals tugging at clothes and giving you that slightly different look, peeing and pooping on things, and a slight posture change is the order of the day. Now is the time to prepare and separate your pairs. Once it's on, and any action by us is going to be not nearly as accepted by the animals. It's the five P's. Prior planning prevents poor performance. Oops, litters are preventable and just unacceptable. Wolf dogs depend on us as a community to exist. We are each other's keepers whether we like it or not. Bad actions, irresponsibility, poorly bred animals, failed containment, illegal activities, bites, animal attacks, etc. Well, they're a direct reflection on us all as Wolf Dog people. You don't have to do anything bad to get sucked into that vortex and lumped in with the others. We all should make the effort to attend the few events we have and meet up with each other face to face. It'll give you a much more clarity of who we are as individuals and not just a name on the screen. Well, that's all the time I have for tonight, y'all. I will ask every one of you to please hug your animals close and be grateful for what you have in this world. It could change in the blink of an eye. Thank you all very much, and good night from the Wolf Tejas Den.
No going back now. Can't change your mind.
Does your dog suffer from bad breath, itchy skin, or any of the other common canine ailments? Check the ingredients on your dog food. Do you see wheat, corn, potato, or rice products? Is there a long list of synthetic vitamins? Your dog has the same digestive system as a wolf, coyote, dingo, or any other kind of wild dog. But when was the last time you heard of wolves or coyotes attacking farmers' wheat or corn crops? Hedobe is a family-owned business that produces premium raw dog food from local ingredients. Our products are preserved through freezing, not chemicals or heat pasteurization. Do your dog and yourself a favor and start feeding your dog according to their design with Pedobe Premium Raw.
This is Linda Michaels, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Join us on October 24th as George Stapleton interviews Dr. Ian Dunbar. Dr. Dunbar shares with us what he has been doing since we spoke to him last and the new initiatives he and his family are bringing to his training regime. Don't miss this fantastic interview with Dr. Dunbar. I invite Wisconsin Wolf Advocates to join Alan Lacey and myself for a Wisconsin premiere of the Gray Area Wolves of the Southwest. This screening takes place in Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, October 18th at 7 p.m. After the screening, there will be a question and answer session with Gray Area Wolves of the Southwest producer Alan Lacey, Humane Society of the United States, Wisconsin State Director Melissa Tedrow, Robert Mann, Ho-Chunk Nation Elder, Fox Lights inventor and owner Ian Wallen, Randy Jurowitz, retired Wisconsin DNR Wolf Program Administrator, and I will be emceeing the panel discussion. You can go to www.wolvesofdouglascountywisconsin.com for ticket information. Wolves face constant threats of delisting and trophy hunts on them and need you to stand up for them. I would like to thank Wolf Dog Radio producers Deanna Moose and Greg Largent for their efforts in helping to promote this film and the Wisconsin premiere of this film, and Alan Lacey for producing a film about the critically endangered Mexican gray wolf. Please show your support of Wisconsin's wild wolf by attending this event. If you have any questions about this show, please email us at questions@wolfdogradio.com and come check out our website at www.wolfdogradio.com for more information. Thank you for making me a part of your day. Good night. This is Rachel Tilseth, asking you to not only talk the talk, but walk the walk for wolves and wildlife.
You are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.